Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, Ramblers, and welcome to the latest Ramble Meets, and it's one I was very excited about doing. Let's go back in time to 1992, where teenage me is at Brixton Academy, London's premier mid-sized concert venue, and, as luck would have it, just up the road from where I grew up. I'm 15, on Come Ride, and the sound is just so big, it fills my head and my chest, and it's all-consuming and unbelievably exciting. Very much like going to a big away match, actually. I eventually get myself a VHS copy of Ride Live at Brixton, and when I came to finally bite the bullet and chuck out my video recorder a few years back, the two VHS cassettes I'd left were that one and 110 Great Goals Italia Style, which was full of Hullet, Maradona, and narrated by the late, great Peter Brackley. Now, fast forward to earlier this year, when I'm in the control room at TalkSport waiting to do my normal Monday afternoon European football roundup on Hawksby and Jacobs, and I'm looking at the guests who are on air at the time, and I listen to them talking knowledgeably about the game, and I think to myself, these two look a bit like Mark and Steve from Ride. I can only see the backs of their heads at the time. They also sound a bit like Mark and Steve from Ride. So that's how my path ended up crossing with today's guest, Mark Gardner, Ride singer, and also a huge fan of Oxford United, his and his band's hometown team. I loved having this chat, not just because I'm an admirer of Mark and his work, but because I really felt his passion for his club, and it made me think about my relationship with my own club and how it relates to my life. And I hope it will make you feel the same when you listen to the episode. So if we go back to your childhood, what are your first memories of football from when you were a child, Mark?
Well, so, I mean, interestingly, so my dad, when he, well, my late father, when he was alive, he actually was a trustee at Oxford United.
Okay.
I don't know. He probably possibly wasn't at that time when he first started taking me up there, but it was just, yeah, it was the classic thing. I was 6 years old. And I remember being taken up to my first game, sitting on the front, you know, the little wall of what was then Oxford United, the Manor, in which would be the Beach Road side, which was actually pretty dodgy when you think about it, because quite often the ball used to just fly and knock people off the wall, you know. But anyway, I remember just sitting on the front wall and thinking, wow, this is one, you know, incredible. Like, what is this? It's like football. And I mean, my dad, you know, his dad before him, I mean, it's totally in the family. So his dad actually took my dad up when they were Headington. They sort of became Oxford United. So they would have known, you know, the likes of Ron Atkinson and Graham Atkinson and players like that that used to play for the early Oxford United when it became Oxford United and came into the league, which I think was, when was that? I mean, they came in place of Atkinson. I can't remember when. I mean, a long time ago. Don't know exactly when. Anyway, so 6 years old on the Beach Road wall. Would have been my first memories of going up to see Oxford United at the Manor Ground, basically. Yeah,
it's funny, isn't it, how that was up until I guess probably the mid to late 80s. That was the given thing at every football ground, in that like small kids were kind of passed to the front, weren't they? So they would get this view. And presumably their dads could have a drink at the back or whatever.
Yeah, I think my dad used to always have a hip flask. I sort of started to work that out because he always seemed to be pretty jolly at football times. I was like, okay, you know. So and we used to sort of be able to walk there from where we were living in Oxford at that time, when we were actually lived in the city at that point before we moved more to the countryside. So and it all kind of tied in with me getting really into Sabutio and stuff like that as well. So my dad also used to sort of walk me to the one shop in Headington, which was where the Manor was in Oxford, and where they sold Sabutio. So I was kind of, you know, he just completely, you know, got me into football. And I remember also sitting with my dad watching some of the early memories of the World Cup, you know, which would have been, Argentina, 78, so I'd have been 8 then, you know, some of the early World Cup. So yeah, it's that kind of classic father-son sort of bonding thing, yeah.
Yeah, and I suppose, like, you know, when you were a kid, and I see this now with my children who are both under 10, when you experience football in a live context, it makes much more sense than football on television when you're little, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I remember watching those programs, and they became instantly more interesting to me because I'd been going to see live games. You suddenly get it. Like, whereas, you know, and it was kind of, what was it, Saint and Greavesy and Brian Moore? Is it Brian Moore on the soccer thing? I mean, you know, I remember those coming on, as well as, of course, Match of the Day, obviously, is just, you know, one of the greatest programs ever. So, you know, that was always going on. And, but it yeah, there's nothing like being there. Then you completely got it. And you know, for a kid of 6 years old, I mean, my daughter's five. She's you know, I kind of did say to her recently, oh, do you want to come to watch a game of football with daddy? And she was just sort of like, certainly not. It's like not quite the response I wanted, but I was like, so yeah, I think she needs a few more years, you know what I mean? But yeah, it was yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it's that live, that, yeah, because you've never experienced anything like that, but you know, before, really.
Yes, it's like everything else, really, almost apart from what's on the pitch, like the smells, the sounds, that other people, all of that. It's also vivid, isn't it? I mean, I kind of think even quite small kids like totally get what going to football is about, because such a small part of it is the actual game.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly that. And it's all that stuff going on around you. And I think, you know, early days, it teaches you also about, you don't always win. I mean, especially supporting Oxford United, you know, it's like, it teaches you about taking losses, you know, which of course you're always really competitive as a kid, and you kind of do things and you always want to win at things. But yeah, that kind of starts to show you, oh no, you don't always win. You know, it's like, you really don't. Yeah.
So by the time you're a teenager, we're kind of into Oxford's golden era, aren't we? After Robert Maxwell's bought the club and Oxford reached the top flight, the win, the 1986 Milk Cup. I mean, are these your most vivid favourite memories of being an Oxford fan?
They're not. I mean, they were. I mean, they're amazing memories. And of course, I caught it at a great time because, yeah, so I would have been 15, 16 when the whole Milk Cup final thing happened, and when we went into the top leagues.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it was, I mean, at that time it was absolutely crazy because it was such a little ground, the Manor. And of course I didn't really appreciate it at that time until I started to travel with what was then called the London Road Club to go to, I mean, you know, it was kind of my first sort of introduction into touring in a strange kind of way, because I used to go on a bus. By the time, I think I was like 14, 15, my dad was happy enough for me at that age to sort of go off on, they used to lay on, you know, the coaches and go to away games as well. So I used to, I started to go and see some of the bigger grounds and sort of tour the country in a way, which was amazing. And that was because, of course, you were like, oh wow, the Manor's quite small compared to some of these stadiums and stuff that I'm going to, you know, in the top leagues. But yeah, so those memories were vivid. And also the being like standing in the London Road, as it was called then, which was, you know, obviously behind our goal. It was completely crazy, the atmosphere. And also quite dangerous at times, because I remember like opposition fans would suddenly make, you know, appear in there, and then there was all sort of scuffles going on, and it was just absolutely sort of bonkers in a way. My memories of it, which were amazing, and obviously going to Wembley and watching Oxford win. I mean, I remember making a flag for about 2 weeks before Wembley, so I made a sort of massive flag, which I sort of obviously took, you know, wrapped myself, and went to that game with,
that's it, isn't it? I mean, when you think of that era for Oxford, like I think for some of our younger listeners, they'll be like, hang about, Dean Saunders, John Aldridge, Ray Houghton played for, they had some incredible players.
Yeah, we did at that time. And of course, I just remember the likes of, so I totally remember, you know, Arsenal's, Man United. So Alex Ferguson's first game in charge was Oxford United away.
Oh, right.
And we beat them. I just, so I remember things like that. And I know I remember also the fallout and hearing on the radio that Man U fans sort of saying, who is this guy? Yeah, we've been to Oxford United and been beaten. But yeah, I mean, the team at that point was amazing. It's like Billy Hamilton as well was another one. Yeah. Who used to play amazingly alongside Aldridge. A lot of those guys you mentioned went on to be in the Republic of Ireland sort of World Cup team as well as sort of onto Liverpool and places like that. A lot of them went to Liverpool, I suppose. Aldridge, Dean Saunders, yeah.
Are you like the Southampton of the day, in essence?
I guess, yeah. And I suppose at that time I didn't really appreciate how crazy it was that Oxford United were in there because I was a teenager, and you don't kind of realize all the mechanics that are going on around that. And of course, I suppose at the end of the day, we were being funded by Maxwell, which is utterly dodgy, because I guess he was then spending everyone's pension money that, you know, wasn't his. So little did anyone know. I mean, of course, we didn't realize then, but of course, around that time as well, there was some serious unrest within the club, because then Maxwell also then kind of started to announce that he was going to merge Reading and Oxford together and call it the Thames Valley Royals. So he kind of kept coming in with some ridiculous ideas. And then, of course, I remember then riots on the pitch, people protesting against that, which also really stuck in my mind, as well as riots on the pitch when, as we talked pre this, you know, when sort of the likes of Swindon people came before we were in the top leagues. But yeah, those sort of memories really stick out, because it's also the first time that I'd sort of seen people kind of fighting stuff, you know, on a pitch, and, you know, but sure, the golden time that was an amazing period. Yeah. And also I kind of, you know, Oxford would have been in Europe at that point had English clubs not been, you know, barred from Europe at that time, which was post Liverpool, wasn't it? The Hazel thing. So,
yeah, it's interesting actually, because like quite a lot of these themes are quite sort of familiar to me, because I'm a Wimbledon fan, and I started going probably about like 87. So, firstly, at the end of the first season where I was going regularly, we won the FA Cup, and I presumed it would be the first in a long list of trophies, but you just don't know, do you? And secondly, what you were saying about the merger, because around 86, 87, there was a mooted Wimbledon Crystal Palace merger. And I guess Wimbledon were in a similar situation to Oxford in that they were essentially playing top flight football in what was not that much better than a non-league ground. So it kind of believed, while that stadium situation exists, it leaves the club in a very vulnerable position, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you needed a Maxwell with dodgy money coming in. it does. But of course, I mean, it was years after that I started to realise how vulnerable a club like Oxford United was when they were kind of potentially, you know, going out of business and stuff like that, which we'd probably get onto a bit later. But absolutely. I enjoyed it all immensely. You're right. People now would never really understand that for a couple of seasons, Oxford were up in the top flight. Good times.
yeah, for sure. Well, by the time you're in your late teens, that's when Ryder really taking off. Of course, this is like pre-internet. So how do you follow the games when you're on the road with the band?
At those points, it was tricky. I would phone home a lot just to see what the results were. As and when we were on tour. I mean, to this day, any time between touring schedules I could get to games, I always would. And I still do that. It was more kind of just like phone home and speak to dad and see how they did. And I'd know immediately, just in the tone of my dad's voice when he sort of picked up the phone. It's like, ooh, doesn't sound too good. I think that was really it. And because I can't think there was any other real way of knowing really at that time. Yeah, because I mean, even it sort of first girlfriends at that time, that was the only way to sort of communicate with those, was just sort of, you know, when you got to a hotel or something and you'd just phone after phone and just see what was going on in the world outside your bubble world of touring, really.
Well, I'm relieved to know that you didn't spend all the royalties from Nowhere on Club Call anyway. I mean, that was the biggest racket of the 1980s.
What was Club Call again? What was that?
Well, basically, you'd ring this number and they'd have one for each club, and it would tell you the news about your club while they were charging you about a quid a minute in a really slow voice.
A little
snippet from a player or whatever.
Yeah, so, no, I didn't do that. I had dad call instead. But then we did. Yeah, but although that was, of course, the time when any phone call from any hotels, you were being absolutely rinsed as well. So, a lot of royalties were wasted in that way. But there we go.
So you were obviously on Creation, which had My Bloody Valentine and Primal Scream. And latterly, once we get to the start of the 90s, Oasis. I mean, we know Creation was a big party scene and all the bands on it looked as if they were having an amazing time together. How much was football a currency there, especially post-Oasis? Because they were always, I mean, you know, I think back to their first couple of singles, when they were on the front cover of the NME, they were posing in Manchester City kits. And this was back when, you know, pre-money, when City were pretty average.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at that time, I think with the likes of, I never really remember having any football banter with, you know, any of those pre-mentioned bands apart from Oasis, and when we started to get to know Noel and Liam and those guys. But I guess at that point, we were starting, things were not so good for us. And obviously they kind of came in, they were coming in, and you know, it's like whatever they talked about, they seemed, you know, they just, their meteoric sort of rise started, and you could sort of see that happening really. But I mean, I do remember talk, because I mean, again, one of the grounds that I visited with Oxford United away was Main Road, you know, the old Man City ground. So I remember that. And I also remember that being a place where you just, you know, everyone was just throwing coins at us. Like, it was just like, crikey, like, you know, mad. But again, one of the grounds that I really wanted to see, because strangely, probably just before I started going to watch Oxford United, and it was the sort of days of having the soccer cards, I actually liked Man City, but only purely because I liked the light blue kit, you know. And I remember like Dave Watson, Joe Corrigan, you know, those people that played for City. So I'd started to pick that out as a team that I sort of thought, that they're quite nice to support. But then until I started going to watch Oxford United, then of course it's like, nah, this is my club and that's that. But yeah, so it was a ground that I wanted to go and see back in the day, and did with Oxford United as well as loads of others. But back to the whole Creation thing, I think because probably the music thing, the way it was starting to happen for everybody, not everybody, but certainly those bands that you mentioned on that label at that time, it just took over everything really. You know, you couldn't. It was just such a whirlwind that we all sort of felt we were in, I guess, at that point, that even football was, it was hard to sort of keep up with, you know, life as it was, you know, before, you know, the rise of our sort of bands, basically. I mean, I guess the word, it felt very all-consuming. And also that was also why it kind of happened with those bands and with those people, because I mean, certainly from our own, I mean, people don't realize, but actually we did do the pub tours, we did the transit van tours, like constantly. And, you know, and we did, you know, support it very, not for long, but in the early days with working sort of jobs as well. So we were just like round the clock, basically, just to try and make it happen. And then, of course, when it started to break and go well, then it just demanded that we were, you know, that then went from being in the UK to being world tours and, you know, around Europe and to America and Japan. Like in Japan, I mean, you never thought you'd be going to Japan. But so, yeah, suddenly we were then kind of like, oh, wow, okay, our whole world now and is being planned, and we've got to try and sort of keep up with this now, yeah.
Yeah, well, with that in mind, actually, I mean, you've talked, all of you in the band have talked at length before about how Going Blank Again, the second album, was a kind of high point for you, both creatively and in terms of enjoyment. But when you look back on the band's first spell, like pre-breakup, can you kind of draw parallels with the life of a young football team that grows together? Because at the beginning, you're just doing it rather than thinking it or planning it. And then recognition and pressure changes things. I guess the parallel I would make football-wise in the modern world is like Borussia Dortmund, like pre and post 2013 Champions League final, because once the world knows who you are and expect a certain something from you, that changes the atmosphere inside, doesn't it?
Massively. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I still do. There are real parallels between, because of course that thing of performance, you know, there's an expectant you know, expectancy on performance being brilliant all the time. And you know, and of course, when you start moving around touring, it's that's quite a thing to deal with on its own, let alone then arrive and be performing at your peak all the time, which of course, you know, that's just, you know, everyone that doesn't tour around or anything like that would just expect that from footballers, you know, and give them a hard time or like, what's up with him? But I mean, you know, it's quite a, that's a challenging place to be, you know, basically. And it did, it made me sort of respect some of these footballers more. I mean, you know, obviously footballers are athletes and, you know, much more so than most band people. You know, so yeah, I you know, I kind of get it, but yeah, you're in a way, I suppose when it's happening, your life isn't your own anymore. I mean, because like you say, when you're known, I mean, freedom is being anonymous basically. And, you know, once you're known and once things start to happen, suddenly your life isn't your own in a lot of ways. You're just, you see, I mean, as for footballers, I guess, you know, you've got your whole, you know, months ahead of you, you know, exactly what you're doing, you know, where you've got to be, you know, come however you feel, whatever's going on, you've got to be there and you've got to, you know, the show goes on, the match goes on basically. So, and I suppose that's more so for a band, because a band, you know, you can maybe get away with, you know, having, I don't know, bronchitis or something and still just about pulling off a show and, you know, but I suppose with footballers, you just can't, I mean, you hit a point where you can't physically perform at that high level all the time if you're ill or whatever. But it is that thing where the show goes on, whatever, and it is you know, a game where you just look at the next few years and it's all mapped out basically. And you know, I found that pretty hard after a while, because I'd sort of was someone that thought, you know, being in a band, it's all about freedom and peace and love and all that stuff. I mean, I really bought into that, but actually the reality is, it's like, oh right, okay, actually, when I was anonymous, I felt more free than I do now, in a way.
Where's that point then for you that you realise that you're on a treadmill rather than just living the dream?
I suppose you feel like that when you're just on tour at times. There's different sides to me with it, with music, because in some ways I still feel, even now that, you know, I still work really hard with the whole music thing just so that I can still do it. Of course, a footballer at my age now wouldn't be playing professional football, but in some ways we can still be playing professional and higher level gigs even than we were playing back in the day then. So there's, you know, there's that side to it. So it's just that whole sort of performance thing. So yeah, but yeah, so living the dream thing. Yeah. So I think, yeah, back then at times, that's right, on the touring side, when you're just locked in repetition every night, and then you realize actually it's just like you arrive, you're in a dressing room, you play, and it's like, and of course gigs can be amazing and you love that hour and a half that you play, but the rest of it is just like you can feel like you're totally on a treadmill. And I also just really struggle with the repetition of it, and that you can't actually, you know, I like the whole thing that you create something fresh and new. I mean, that's the real buzz for me, is like when you make and do things which you feel are great, you know, and then you're really, really excited about how people will receive it. And that's an amazing feeling in that sort of within that creative process. But yeah, just when you're on a long tour and it's night after night and you're absolutely physically sort of spent basically, but you just keep going and it's just repetition. That after a while, I find that I do really struggle with that, I have to say.
So after Ride finished up the first time, you went to France for a bit, didn't you? Did you go to games or follow a local team while you were over there?
I didn't, no. I was so in the middle of nowhere. And at that time...
Where were you?
I was I was in the department de la Lotte. So la Lotte, which is underneath the Dordogne area.
Okay.
So it's right in the middle, not certainly not glamorous France in the south, but you know, by the sea, anything like that, like right in the middle, and probably on the same line across as sort of Bordeaux. So sort of down there and right in the middle.
Right.
I'm about an hour and a half, north of Toulouse, but I was so out of the way there and far away from any sort of bigger team. I mean, I probably would have, if I'd have been closer to Toulouse or something, although that's more rugby there, but I probably would have gone to it. But then, but in a way, I'd, you know, it's like now when people sort of say, I've got Arsenal fans in Oxford and they say, oh, we want to come to see the Arsenal. I'm like, no, not really. It's like, you know, my club's Oxford. So, and even then in France, at that time, I'd worked out a way that with my satellite, you know, because you kind of, English people down living down there used to get their sort of sat-nav set up, or not sat-nav, but your satellite TV thing set up so that you could still watch a bit of English TV or tune into some radio. So I was still able then to sort of start tuning into Oxford radio, and I'd just listen then to the commentary in my little barn in the middle of the medieval wilds of France, and jump around in there, you know, and yeah, I mean, just sort of hear it like that, basically. Yeah.
So you were talking about how you didn't feel particularly keen on going to other teams' games. Obviously, in the band, Andy's an Arsenal fan. Steve's a very big Spurs fan. So presumably, if they haven't got you to go to Arsenal and Spurs games, have you got them to go to Oxford games? Because Oxford is such a sort of central force for the band, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Andy sort of got into football later in his life, probably as a result of being in, you know, around the Gallaghers for a while when he was in Oasis. But I know that Steve has been to a lot of Oxford games, and used to come to a lot of Oxford games back in the day. But was always, you know, like adamantly a Spurs fan. But he came to a lot of Oxford games, and certainly the Wembley appearances we've been at, Steve was always there. So I think, you know, Oxford's definitely Steve's second team. But you know, yeah, there we go.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So Oxford have been through it all, really, in this century. So the club almost went out of business in the late 90s before Firoz Kassam took over. And then in 2001, they moved from the Manor to the Kassam, which is a huge difference. And then you look at some of the names that have been in charge since then. I mean, Chris Wilder looks really strange nowadays, doesn't it, when you see what he's doing with Sheffield United. Ramon Diaz, who I remember from Football Italia when I was a kid, he was in charge for a bit as well. I mean, how do you even start to get a handle on that? There's so much going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, firstly, I'm just glad the club is in existence. And I remember my dad at the time, which is going back to what you said about around the late 90s, 1999. I remember it was the time when we were playing Chelsea on an FA Cup, and we were beating them 1-0, and it was the classic, you remember Kevin Francis, the tall black guy who really long legs, He made a perfectly legal tackle in the box, and Viali dived, totally dived in the last minute of that game and got a penalty and got pulled Chelsea back, you know, to 1-1, and then we lost the replay. But on that, actually, my dad was one of the guys who was organising one of the funds that was helping to, created to help keep Oxford players paid at that time. And I remember a big moment for me, as you know, was walking on the pitch with a Rickenbacker guitar on that game, the Oxford Chelsea game. So I went on the pitch at half time and I sold the Rickenbacker for a couple of grand, I think, to help bring some money into the club.
All right.
So that was that was a big moment for me. But yeah, then back to managers. Yeah, people have come and gone, and it's been a little confusing. But I have to say, since Chris Wilder came in, and obviously we then found ourselves in the conference, which was really depressing, and that really depressed my dad when, you know, towards the later years of his life, I've always loved Chris Wilder. I just felt that from the time that he came in, ever since then, the club has slowly been back on the up, you know, and it has basically, you know, although it's been a bit up and down, but it's basically, you know, been on the up ever since. And also I totally understand how the difficulties now with, you know, the likes of Kassam in the background and stupid rent that we're paying for what is basically a three-sided sort of stadium that was never finished, because in his sort of strange mind, he thought that during the summer he'd be putting on concerts there, which he did once. Elton John played there once, and that was that. So he kept one of the ends open because he thought, you know, I mean, it's just nuts. But we're definitely coming towards a place where something has to budge and change now, because I think the lease for that ground is going to come up soon. I think it's in the next sort of couple of years. So something has to change. And of course, the fans put a kind of, I think it's something like for a community order on the ground, so that it can't, you know, it's like something for the community. So it's like it's sort of legislation that means that he just can't just sell it off for housing, basically, you know. Yeah. So that has gone on as well. But yeah, you know, I mean, I think I've really, you know, from the Wilder, and even in the conference stage, just getting out of the conference, and I remember the playoff final with York. I mean, that was an incredible afternoon. That probably is even more vivid to me, and more of a highlight in a way for me than the Milk Cup final. Yeah, because I think at that point, had Oxford not got out of the conference at that time, which is an incredibly difficult division to get out of, because it's only
really
the top team that goes up, and then it's, you know, like, you know, the next four that play off. But for me, that was the highlight, because I just figured that if we don't get out of the conference at that time, then this club could die, basically. And also, it's tinged with sadness a little bit, because I knew that my dad wasn't well at that time, and he was sort of saying that, you know, before I kind of say goodbye, I just want to, it'd be great to know that Oxford United are back in the league. And it happened, you know, that really happened for him. So, I just remember when the third goal went in, because that was really tense as well. It was like 2-1 all through the second half on that. So, you know, and then until the last few minutes when Alfie Potter, you know, Sam Deering passed Alfie Potter, made it 3-1. And then we knew that we'd actually done it, and we were out. Well, you know, we're back in the league. And that was probably one of the best moments I've ever known supporting Oxford. Yeah.
So when you talked about Elton playing at the Kassam, did you guys never get an offer?
No, I don't. I think we possibly were not on Kassam's radar. <It's> like, you know, it's just so bizarre, that whole thing. No, we didn't. No. And I mean, yeah, it's just. I know everything about Kassam is just a shame, you know. It's just, yeah, awful. So, here we are. You know, we're doing. Before obviously everything stopped, we were back. You know, the highest place that I've known Oxford for 20-odd years. You know, back to. So I don't know, but there's still just this ongoing problem all the time with Kassam and that stadium and the club needing to own its stadium. And, you know, I think until that's really resolved, then we, you know, the club, it's always going to sort of drag the club back a bit, really.
Well, I mean, it's easy to criticise the ground for being three-sided, but as an away fan, I always found it quite comforting that you could keep an eye on your car whilst the game was going on. So every cloud has a silver lining in that, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, it's Oxford. There's not too much car crime around there. It's a bit of a rough area, actually, where the ground actually ended up being built. I mean, I remember at school on one of my... I think it was a joy. I mean, that ground was, they tried to relocate that ground for so long. And I remember even being a like 17 year old doing a sort of geography A level kind of project, which was, you know, which I brought into the relocation of Oxford United football ground within Oxford. And I actually interviewed John Aldridge for it.
Which, oh, really?
He was really cool because he kind of just got that, you know, I was a big fan. And, yeah, I just ended up sitting with John Aldridge for a while and he, you know, just getting a player's sort of view on it. And of course, I suppose even then you don't realise, well, players are on the move anyway, so they're not that bothered about it. But, but yeah, he was cool. He was very cool. And that was kind of like another sort of big moment for me for, you know, and for my geography, sort of geography coursework, you know.
That's really weird. That was my exact GCSE geography project, looking for a new ground for Wimbledon.
Oh, wow. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, of course, we've got all that in common completely. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, same things. Yeah. But before we let you go, you've been super generous with your time, Mark.
That's right.
Tell us about the most recent album, This Is Not a Safe Place, because you guys have been back touring and making new records for the last couple of years. You've worked on these last couple of albums with Errol Alkan. I mean, how important is that to make it all new and fresh?
I mean, Errol's great. Well, Errol's just a lovely guy. He's a total eclectic music man. Obviously, Errol's quite known for more for his sort of DJ.
Yeah,
techno stuff. But I mean, he was running sort of indie clubs in London back in the day as well. So he's fully. I mean, like ourselves, we're all completely eclectic as well with what we listen to and what we like as a band. I mean, we definitely don't. It's kind of obviously we get the bizarre. I mean, you know, we get the shoegaze tag or whatever. But I mean, I don't really know any of us that listen to a lot of that. You know, it's a wide genre, but we don't check a lot of that music out. You know, in a way. So, you know, Errol was great, and I mean, I think with the band, you know, where Errol is really good is that we obviously as individually bring in a lot of ideas. And when we come to make these records, we've had some time just to sort of get ideas and stuff together. And he was just really good at kind of helping sort of, you know, zoom in on like these are the ones I think we should work on. It's just that fresh pair of ears that of someone that you kind of trust in a way. And in that sort of slightly DJ mentality as well of like, that goes in, that's good to go next to that one, not that one. And that really actually helps. But I think with the freshness thing, I think just purely because we all listen to a lot of new music now, I think each record we've made has always been pretty different to the last, not because we're trying to do that, but just because that's how it comes out, that's how it works with us. So I think they would have been pretty fresh anyway, because we're still very reactive to what's happening around us now, musically and in the world. And I, you know, that's sort of always my feed now, rather than, you know, just tapping back to kind of old music and trying to recreate that, which doesn't really, you know, I'm not really that interested in that. I think you've got to try and do things for tomorrow still as much as you can. There's plenty of things to inspire and react against and work with now, you know, and it has been over the last few years since we've been back. And I think for me that was always the real challenge. I mean, of course, it was lovely to come back and play some massive shows and headline massive festivals around the world, and realize that in our absence the music that we'd made had grown and grown, even though we hadn't been a band for that time, you know. So it was just so nice to reconnect and do that. But I think that would have quickly felt old if, you know, I didn't want this to be a kind of a nostalgia trip in a way, you know. I mean, because to me that's just, of course, it's lovely and fresh to kind of play that stuff initially. But then the real challenge for me was always about, and why I just thought we should do it, because I just felt we've still got loads more music in us that can take to move it on, you know, take people to some new interesting places as well as some other places they've known. And I think we, you know, we've managed to do that. So that was for me the ultimate challenge. And yeah, you know, that sort of vindicates the whole reunion thing for me, really. Because I, you know, I think a lot of bands, without starting to name people, have kind of done that, and a lot of them just have not come back with interest in new material at all. It's been pretty awful, really, you know. And I think that's the real acid test of it. If that kind of chemistry is still there with the people, then you can create interest in new music, you know. And if it's not there, then no matter what you do, music is completely transparent in that way. You know, it just won't work. You people can just hear when bands have still got that chemistry or when that chemistry is gone, really. So
Ride doing these fantastic big shows, Oxford pushing towards the championship, Chris Wilder slaying the Premier League. I mean, it's all set for a better 2021, isn't it?
Let's hope so. You know, I mean, I think the thing that also obviously changed with Chris Wilder is the Alan Neil connection, which I think maybe gets a bit overlooked at times.
Yeah.
Because I think after Oxford, I think he then made that connection with Alan Neil, and I think as a duo, those people have just incredible. I mean, what a combination! Wherever they've gone, it's just been a total success. And I'm really pleased for Chris Wilder, because, like I say, I love what he did for Oxford at the time. And yeah, I think it's just great to see a guy like that. That, you know, I mean, you know, before he came to Oxford, he was like at Halifax and places like that. That has come through, and it is really doing it. You know, in the Premiership, it's fantastic. Yeah, and of course, before, you know, this stop, I mean, we were really on a roll. And but I suppose that's going to be the same for all clubs. It's going to be really weird when they come back and restart, because it's just odd. I mean, yeah, it's just I mean, we live in these times are just so bizarre what's going on now. But it's almost like it's going to be almost, well, completely starting again, isn't it? It's like sort of, I mean, it must be really tough on a player when you know, I mean, for us, Matty Taylor has been on fire for us the last, you know, he just seemed to be getting better and better and better. Mm. And you just wanted it to continue, because I just think had it continued like that, I thought we were looking really good for even automatics at the way we were going. And I was just so gutted that it's kind of, you know, stopped. But obviously, you know, we know why it stopped. This thing's even more important than football, you know, so.
Hard to believe, I know.
Yeah. But yeah, I hope so. I mean, with Ride, we've obviously come to the end of the cycle of touring. I mean, we were lucky because we played a pretty big sold out show in Milan, which was, I think, right at the start of February. So we just probably were, I mean, looking at it, probably maybe just a week before the virus cases started it started to be talked about in Northern Italy. So yeah, we were really lucky on our timing, because, you know, life's really difficult enough anyway for bands and especially new artists. Anybody now trying to sort of still make a kind of living with music is not easy anymore. So I really feel for all those people that, you know, were set for their tours and stuff, and it's just all had to, you know, stop. It's tough. It's really, really tough. So, you know, anyway, I don't know if you want to get into that, but, you know, I've been kind of self-isolating for the best part of the last 2 weeks. Wasn't sure if my partner had, well, we don't know if it's kind of come through us or not. You know, I mean, I'm now self-isolating on my own back in my studio, which I was sort of that's the thing with studio work. A lot of the time you're self-isolating anyway, you know. I mean, it's because a lot of the work you do before it comes to a band or before you tour is quite isolated and just, you know, myself in a studio really. So I will be able to get back to some of that work, you know, now, but obviously the big curveball is now you've kind of got children at home now that need looking after as well. And it's, yeah, I mean, everything's just, yeah, it's kind of, yeah, the world has been turned upside down really.
Better in the studio than homeschooling, I would argue.
It is, yeah, but then there's now the conference of, you know, it's got to be shared now because, you know, I've got a partner that wants to be doing stuff as well. So it's but of course I'm not going to just suddenly think now I'm back in the studio all the time, okay, you know. So and actually bizarrely it's a really sad, but you get into these lives which, you know, and I, you know, just extremely busy touring, coming back from touring, and then I'm doing my own record and maybe some soundtrack stuff and mixing work. Mm. And it's quite sad in a way, but it almost takes a virus for you to suddenly have to then be at home. And then, you know, in the last week, 2 weeks, I've felt a lot more connected now with my daughter than I've ever really felt. You know, it's weird that it takes some things like that to bring you back to some real fundamentals that you, in the sort of busy world that we live in, that you, you're just busy, too busy all the time, you know. So it's, on that level, it's been good. And it's just a shame that it takes something this awful to bring you back to those places and remind you of actually what you should really value and not be too busy for in a way all the time, you know. So yeah,
this was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously,
man. Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.